Today's talk is given by Dr. Thierry Gregorius of Bix Product Consulting. His talk is entitled Designing a More Human-Centric Approach for GI. Thierry is a GI and geomatics professional with over 20 years' experience in energy, natural resources and environment. And he's worked for companies like Royal Dutch Shell and the Landmark Information Group, where he occupied global and senior leadership positions. For the past 6 years, he has worked as a management consultant with Xperia Consulting, which is a G-Tech group company, and he's currently pursuing his passion for helping people transform how they work, which he has numerous interesting writings about as well, which I recommend. But that's be it with GIS or otherwise, so thoughts on how to work better. Thierry is a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and holds a PhD in satellite geodesy from Newcastle University, to which he recently returned to give this year's GISRAC closing keynote, which was very well received, and therefore we felt we simply had no choice but to encourage him that little bit further up, further north across the border. As it turned out, little encouragement was required. He was most happy to come, but we are, of course, most grateful and honoured, therefore, to welcome Thierry Gregorius.
Thanks, Simon. I appreciate the introduction. That was, so I don't have to introduce myself at all, because that was very far too long to think. But yeah, thank you. I always enjoy having an excuse coming up here to Scotland. I haven't been for a few years, I was supposed to be working today, but I used the day wandering around town and then checking in my email occasionally, pretending to work. My work colleagues down south in London. So, if you're from Exeter last night, where I actually live and work from home most of the time. It's a real privilege to be up here and to give this talk to you. What I'm going to be talking about is really about the more human aspects of geospatial solutions, really. It's really something that's close to my heart and as Owen mentioned, I've given other presentations around that earlier this year. I'm going to talk about a few things. We're going to have a quick recap on geospatial architectures, but then move on to the human elements of positioning, some geodetic horror stories, some geospatial trends and the human aspects of that, and then close up with some thoughts on just what is a geospatial professional as well these days. So I always like to start a presentation with an intriguing image, so I chose this one, which, as you can tell, is quite old. And when I look at that, I think, yeah, geospatial technology has moved on a lot, hasn't it, and that's great. But on the other hand, I'm also thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great fun to be making maps like that still? So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. And this is very much the gist of my presentation as well. Just really early. In terms of just recapping on the evolution of GIS and geospatial more generally. So it's been around for some time now. It's gone mainstream. The architecture of it has evolved from standalone PCs doing stuff with floppy disks onto enterprise platforms and now the cloud. And that's actually, it's been pretty remarkable. I mean, I've been working with GIS now for 20 years. So when I worked for Shell, for example, that was the dawn of enterprise GIS. And I spent a lot of time trying to deploy GIS across a global enterprise, which was actually quite tricky. Whereas now with the cloud, it's become so much easier for anybody, small organizations, big organizations. It's actually become harder for the larger ones than the smaller ones. It's actually now the reverse. In the past, it was easier for the large organizations with huge budgets to do cool things, but now, if anything, it's the reverse now. So the stuff you had to deal with enterprise GIS was an absolute nightmare, because you had to deal with all these layers and you had to deal with all these groups, and they all had competing interests, and it was an absolute nightmare to orchestrate all of that. Whereas now with the cloud, you know, and I'm using Asri examples here, but of course you could substitute this with open source stuff as well. It's just Expedite, we're an Asri partner, so that's why I call them like screenshots are Asri based, but you can supplant them with open source if you like, it's the same thing. So now with the cloud you can literally switch it on, you can have it on any device, anywhere, do pretty much anything you want with it. What's also happened is that geospatial representations of information on a map or whatever has just become one representation out of a lot of other choices, because there's a lot of other ways of processing data and trying to analyze and making sense of it. So with tools like R or tools like use business intelligence applications, stuff like that. So you can do a lot of things with data, and it doesn't always have to be in maps. So that's the other thing with GIS having mainstream. It's also become like an element of a larger family of tools and approaches to how you treat data, which has been accepted by the wider community. So over the years, we've really gone from an approach where GIS was always your universe, you know, GIS was always like in the middle of every slide you ever saw in the last 20 years, you always had GIS in the middle and everything else branched out to that. Whereas now it's really sprinkling everything with geospatial intelligence, really, whether that's other IT systems or other approaches or whatever. So you don't always have to do everything within the GIS now. To do geospatial work means spatializing or spatially enabling whatever you're doing. It doesn't have to happen through GIS anymore necessarily. And of course, what's also happened is it's consumerized. You know, it's everybody's got access to it now on their smartphone. Having said that, as a consultant, and I still come across that a lot as well, you still deal, and there were some battles and preconceptions, especially with professionals, ironically, again. So also there, it's maybe gone upside down. It used to be that a professional used to know why you should be doing it a certain way, whereas now with consumers, they become so accustomed to stuff that they're using effectively GIS in their smartphones without realizing it, and they are instinctively doing the right thing. Whereas I often still have conversations with people like geologists saying, why do you need a GIS when you can just annotate a JPEG? When you can interpret your geology in PowerPoint and draw on it in PowerPoint. And also, within our own community, there's still a lot of, on Twitter you see a lot of this, where people just enjoy winding each other up, like with a love of old ways of doing things, exporting to shapefile and stuff like that. So shapefile even has its own Twitter handle. So if you go on that, it's quite amusing, some of the tweets that come out of that. Anyway, so that was a quick history of spatial architectures and where we are. So just to say a little bit about it, since this presentation is about the human aspects of it, I thought I'd throw in a bit of geodesy in as well. I haven't practiced as a geodesist for nearly 20 years either, but I thought it's really anyway, in terms of the horror stories, and because it is important. So geodesy is really about, or spatial integrity is really about keeping stuff aligned. I think you all know what that means. But it's harder to do than, it's easy to understand the concept. I'm not quite sure what happened there in this particular instance. It's probably not a geodetic fail. It's probably more of a fail, a case of you had one job and you planted the trees in the middle of the pavement. I don't know how you'd even do that. To err is human, and particularly in the oil industry where I started my career, there's been some pretty spectacular disasters that were purely due to misinterpretations and not really understanding coordinate reference systems. So this is one example in Louisiana where an oil rig was meant to go out on a lake to drill a new well, and they'd confused a transverse Mercator projection, which was specifically designed for that area, with a generic UTM projection. And they're almost the same, but they just shifted slightly. And this slight shift resulted in the rig being slightly in the wrong position, but it was enough to drill in the wrong place. And what happened is they drilled through a mine shaft that was underneath the lake. And as a result, that lake drained in a matter of a few minutes. The people who were on the rig miraculously escaped. You know, they went on an inflatable and escaped to the shoreline. But the shoreline was quickly coming in. You have to imagine that, you know. The shoreline was quickly disappearing down a massive sinkhole. And all of that just because of misread coordinates, really. So it can have massive consequences. Here's another example that I had the pleasure of being CC'd on when I did work. It wasn't a company I worked for, but this was an oil rig in the Indian Ocean. Well, I don't know what company, I think it was an Indian oil company. And because they were supposed to drill close to the equator, they managed to misread latitude north or south or the other way around. And as a result, they drilled a well. I mean, you have to imagine how expensive it is. It's close to $100 million, an offshore well like that. They managed to drill it 400 kilometers away from its intended location. Needless to say, they didn't find any oil. It's easily done. So all I can say is just really be careful with this. And whenever you're working with end users, who aren't as spatially aware as you are, just make them realize that you need to be careful with these things, especially when you work across borders or anything like that. If you just work in the UK on the Northern Survey grid, well then fine, the risk is quite low, but as soon as you start mixing coordinate systems, it's quite tricky. Just a few thoughts on the kind of frontiers of geospatial and where we are these days. So, you see a lot of stuff about 3D, 3D digital twins, 3D BIM, that kind of stuff, and it is happening more and more, also in the industry, industries where I've worked, in energy, environment, property. You have more and more of these applications, and you can do some amazing things with them. A couple of months ago, I was in Australia doing some work for an Australian gas company, and there were, unfortunately, I can't show any screenshots from them, but you could really see it coming together. They built a complete 3D model of an operating plant, an LNG plant, and they've linked it with IoT sensors, so you can see real-time data streaming in, and you can see it in the 3D model. You can walk around the 3D model, and you can look at the data that's streaming in real-time in the model, and that really helps engineers plan and react and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff you can do, and it's really coming together now, literally like a bricolage. Where geospatial provides the framework to ensure that everything is in the right place, providing you do get your spatial integrity right. This is another example where it becomes important. And you can do pretty much anything now. Which is a blessing as well as a curse, really. You can literally do anything, you know, with GIS or technology now, geospatial or otherwise. So the question really becomes, what's the use case? Why are you doing it? What exact problem are you really trying to frame here? Because the thing is also that anyone can do it now. As professionals, it's quite easy for end users to not ask for our help or advice, because there's a lot of tools out there for people to do stuff themselves, which works up to a point, but then it doesn't. And also with all the technology, and because we've always been really really excited about new shiny tools in our profession, there's always been the kind of attitude of, oh yeah, here's a new tool, so what can we do with it, rather than asking, so what's the problem and which tools do we need for that. So as a consultant again in the last few years, I've come across a lot of examples of just because you can. Now, when there's a new tool allowed and people just want to use it, but it's not really serving any real purpose. Although you can cut bread with a MacBook Air, apparently, but that's not really what it's designed for, is it? And there's probably easier solutions and cheaper ones too. I was quite intrigued by this example that kind of illustrates that point. It was in the news earlier this year that the US Navy they're actually reversing some of the rollout of their state-of-the-art and the display screens on the bridges where they used to have wheels and knobs and levers and stuff, and they've replaced all of those with touch screens. And I've actually, investigations have shown that these touch screens have actually caused some accidents because they're not so easy to use or not so intuitive, or because they're not using your hands, or because everything is together on one screen rather than distributed. I don't know, but they decided to replace them again with wheels and knobs and dials and whatever, because it's just more intuitive. So that really illustrated that point quite well. Another illustration of you also need to use the tools for their purpose that they're designed for. This was a tweet that came out earlier by this comedian Joe Wilkinson. I don't know if you follow him, but and if you try this, it is quite funny. If you ever tried this, if you do take your GPS on the train with a ask it for route directions, it is quite funny how it goes mad and recalculates the whole time. And especially if you're on a fast train, it's even better. So it's really about creating solutions that people need. And that's true for geospatial as is for anything else. You've all seen these examples with shortcuts through parks. I remember in the early days of spatial data infrastructures, SDIs, it was really like SDIs were like these tracks here, nicely paved, but nobody used them because everybody wanted to go the short way. And with the new approaches on the cloud, I think we are getting closer to using shortcuts so that enable people to work the way they want to work rather than the way we think they should be working. And the solution is really not about the tools, it's not about technology. So I'm always intrigued when I'm on Twitter quite a lot. Every so often, you have these things flaring up, these debates, proprietary versus open source. And you have these clashing ideologies. In a way, I think that they missed the point because the solution isn't about the tools. And I put this picture up there on your father, Darth Vader, saying to Luke. If you look at the evolution of GIS, it was probably Esri that started this market, so they are proprietary. So the open source people probably see Esri as this character. But you have to remember that it's an ecosystem. So and the ecosystem of open source and proprietary, like that, they feed off each other, they inspire each other, they feed off each other, they work together. So I'm always dubious of people trying to draw ideological lines between the two, especially when the solution isn't even about the tools. As a consultant, actually, a GIS consultant, I actually spend the least of my time on the tools, on the technology. I spend all of my time on problem definition, use cases, framing the problem, then deciding which geospatial data do you need, and then which tools do you need, and then those people are going to use them, they need support and training, and if it's a big deployment, it needs change management and user group engagement, and these all of these human aspects for the solution to actually succeed, and the tool is just one tiny bit of it. That's really because the solution is all about people. It's about how people use it, it's about the results that people want to achieve. And it's about, and ultimately it's about you working together with people. And you see this chart here, it shows all the communication lines you have with a number of people, which grows exponentially. So So with three people, he only had three communication lines, but with 14 people, he had nearly 100 communication lines between all those people. And I remember that from the, that's one of the reasons why enterprise GIS in large organizations was so hard, because in big organizations, you were dealing with this exponential effect, and you had to roll out stuff to people and groups of people that needed to work together and needed training and support and needed to understand what you were rolling out. And you were actually dealing with this a lot of the time, and the technology was only a small part of it. So you probably all see these approaches, these design thinking approaches, start with the end user's needs, where you really need to look at the whole problem. There was again an example of that. When I started consulting a few years ago, one of my first projects was in Norway. I was going to, there was a team of oil and gas exploration people, they're all geologists. And they were really struggling with their GIS infrastructure. They had spatial data flying everywhere, it was all scattered all over the place. And they just asked us to come in, clean it up a bit, put in some workflows that worked for them. But when I got talking to them, I realized that they were all running around like hens, chickens. So I asked one of the geologists, so how much time do you actually spend doing geology? And he just looked at me and said, oh, probably about a third of the time. So what do you do the other two thirds of your time? And they were spending that time in meetings, process, corporate stuff. They had all the meetings trying to decide where to explore next with all the data they had. So rather than do what they asked us to do, we came to the conclusion that what we really needed to do was to enable them to use GIS in their meetings where they were spending most of their time, rather than at their desktops, where they're only spending a third of their time. So it was really a really good example of a solution being more than just a technology. Because if we'd gone in there and just asked them purely what they asked us to do, then it wouldn't have succeeded. Whereas when we left, they were using GIS in their meetings. They were using GIS live to drive their decisions of where to go. They were doing some work up in the Arctic Sea, it was very successful. So it's really about working with how your end users want to work with their natural inclinations. Some other things, as a consultant, that kind of inspire me is various approaches that can help you really see what the true issues are, the true problems that need your solutions. And sometimes it helps to look at the problem at various scales. You can do that literally like at various map scales, or you can look at it from the whole problem point of view. I was intrigued when I was in the Lego, the biggest store in London. And combine it with these Lego models of these red buses, London buses, and at various scales. And actually, what I found interesting was that if you really wanted to know the essence of a red London bus, it is actually best explained by the smaller scale model. Because all you need to know for it to be a London bus is it is red and it's got two levels, and that defines a London bus really. Everything else is kind of extra detail that can sometimes distract from the real issue. It's like also the geospatial solutions, if you try and look at it at various scales, at various levels, you actually might find the essence more easily of the problem that you're trying to solve. Also in terms of creativity, it's useful sometimes to combine ideas from different things. I was very excited when Lego announced this Dyson Hoover last year. Fortunately, it wasn't April's Fool, so I'm still waiting for it. But wouldn't that be great, a Hoover that automatically sorts your Lego bricks? The other thing is to keep things really, really simple. As geospatial professionals or IT professionals, there's always the temptation to put in more functionality than you need just because we know that you can do it and because it's there. This is just one example I came across earlier this year as well. It's a really simple map on the web. This is Atlanta in America, where they just put together like a postcode map of child well-being index. So it's really not fancy at all. But what they've done with this map is that the local council there has worked with employers to target these red areas where child well-being is low to bring employment into those areas. So there's one company, I think UPS it was, who therefore decided to place one of their new warehouses in one of those red areas, and it's had amazing results apparently. And all that just because of like a simple map interface with really straightforward data in it. But the temptation might have been to develop a super duper, you know, web, you know, gizmo thingy and with geostatistical analysis and all the rest of it, and but actually all you need is to know was where the red area is. Also one of the things I really like is story maps, so multimedia maps, where it's not just about the map but also the other media, so that really helps you tell a story and really helps you explain some of the issues. The other thing that I start thinking more and more is, do we actually need to show spatial data on the map? There's a lot of use cases where you actually don't. If you look at the history of the last 20, 30 years, 20 or 30 years ago, late 80s, early 90s, we started to basically transpose analog processes into electronic processes. So in those days, you were doing like chronological scanning and digitizing. And then from there, then moved on to kind of improving like these digital processes. And now we're talking about transformation, which is really about completely reimagining, you know, digital processes, where everything is already digital. You know, your source data is digital from the word go. It's not like it had to be scanned or digitized. It's already digital from where it comes from. So that means you can re-engineer processes in a way, because also the outputs will also have to be digital. So that allows you to pretty much do quite a lot under the hood without the user actually engaging with any of it, because all you need to know is an answer to a straightforward question. And that trend that actually started a few years ago, and this is an article from 2012, where they already thought, you know, actually this is going to be one of the trends that's coming. And indeed, there's two use cases there highlighted. One of them is a geocoder. It's an open source geocoder called OpenCage Data, I think it's called. You have heard of it. So there's one use case on the left there where they work with a I think with Hertz it is. So all they want to know is the rental car as it crossed into a new country and not has it stayed within the country border. That's all they want to know. So there's no need to build an interface with a map or anything. They only want to be alerted if the car is driven across the border. And you can do that with geospatial, obviously, but you don't have to show it on the map. Also, when I worked at Landmark, we had a lot of these automated environmental reports for professionals or prospective homeowners or whatever. And even though we included quite a lot of maps in some of these reports, also generated reports for solicitors who didn't really want to know the map. They just wanted to know the risk. Is this place at risk of flooding, yes or no? Is there a risk of environmental pollution, yes or no? And you can generate these yes-no answers out of the GIS without showing them on the map. And it was all automated. The other thing is you can share locations now without showing it on the map, also by speaking. You know, probably all heard of what three words. So you can locate yourself anywhere in the world within a 3-meter grid with a unique combination of three words. And this technology has been developed specifically to be spoken words. So that when you're at a music festival and you want to meet up with your friends and you have to describe, I'm next to the hedge by the big tree or whatever, which is quite clunky, so we could use three words for that, for example. And also, of course, when you order anything online these days, this is all driven by geospatial intelligence under the hood, but you won't see that on the map at all. You will just get an email with a notification, your parcel will arrive at this time, at this address, but there isn't any map on that. So we see more and more automation of things, internet of things and all of that stuff. So I am wondering whether, you know, with all this automation and stuff happening under the hood, whether that actually will at last free us up to do all the cool stuff we always wanted to do with spatial data, because anyone who's worked in the geospatial industry for some time probably know that you spend most of your time cleaning up data, or sorting it, or organizing it, or reformatting it, or doing something with it. And you spend only a very small proportion of your time analyzing it, or doing cool stuff with it. So I'm hopeful that with all this automation, we as humans, as geospatial professionals, will be able to do more of the stuff that we enjoy doing as well. So, which brings me to more explicitly human things by geospatial, which is something that's really close to my heart. So, just humor me. It might not be close to your heart, but I'll be intrigued to know. Because having spoken about all these automation and all the new technologies and all that, I'm also yearning for more human ways of working with geospatial data, involving your hands, involving being out in the field, stuff like that. So I showed this screenshot earlier about the 3D model GIS. That was actually from an American city, and that same city, I think it was Boston, they actually have a physical 3D model of the same thing, which they use for engagement with the community. And that works really, really well. Actually, it works a lot better than if you just had it on the screen. And that's for reasons I can't really explain. I think it's to do with the way we humans process information through space, actually. Because our brains have evolved in space with our limbs and everything, so we orient ourselves in space. So if we actually see something that occupies space in front of us, I think we intuitively find that easier to process. Also, earlier today, actually, I went to the art museum here in Edinburgh, the Art Centre, and intrigued to see they had a 3D model of Edinburgh here. It was made in 1829. Although this is a replica, apparently. So that's nearly 200 years ago. I think that's amazing. I mean, it's quite, it looks accurate, I don't know if it is, but, and it said a note there, they're not sure whether that is what Edinburgh looked like at the time, or whether that was how it was planned at the time. It's amazing, and again, it gives you a real understanding in a split second. You can understand what kind of place it is by looking at that. The other thing is, we humans, we love working with our hands, you know. You can see that with children who haven't been taught yet to work like adults. They actually do a lot with their hands. So that's if you remember from school, you know, your lessons. Our hands occupy quite a lot of space in our brains. You know, they're connected to a lot of brain cells, and using our hands uses a lot of brain power as well. But in reverse, when we use our hands, apparently it can unlock a lot of information that's stored in our brains. Perhaps that is why, you know, the US Navy is rolling back on their touch screens. I don't know. Maybe that's why they want their levers and knobs back. But also, more geospatially, I think drawing maps by hand, I mean, it used to be the norm. Obviously, these days, you don't really. But there's still some applications where it's really useful. Apparently, meteorologists, to this day, they still prefer to draw their local weather forecast by hand. And you could interpolate the ISO bars and all of that on a computer, obviously, but apparently they prefer drawing them by hand because they can do it more intuitively. They can move maybe the isobars or whatever a little bit just based on their experience of their local area and historical experience. So it's not quite so black and white. The other thing with doing things in hard copy is it might last longer. Because who in this room has still got shape files made with iView 3.2 20 years ago? I'm not sure if I still love some. I might have, but whereas this map here is nearly 3,000 years old. When it, to be fair, it's in carved in stone, so I'm not saying you should carve our maps in stone, but it does. You know, if you really want a long-lasting artifact, you would probably want to do it in hard copy. And I was intrigued to see that Open Source Geospatial Conference a few years ago, the first prize winner was actually a map drawn by hand, which just goes to show that there seems to be a human need to be able to do things by hand. I also saw this in the news the other day. There's an artist who's gone around, or still going around, the whole of the UK, and he's drawing every city above, by hand. This apparently is a Scottish city, but it's not Edinburgh, I think. Maybe you can guess which one it is, but his exhibitions, they draw quite big crowds. His drawings are really popular. If you go on his website, you can buy prints of them. And it's interesting to see that this human way of sketching is now being replicated in GIS software as well. So with ArcGIS Pro, for example, you can just switch on sketchy edges, as it's called, for your 3D models, and it renders them in an almost like human way of sketching. I guess there's a lot of landscape artists who are see that they cry into their watercolours when it's this easy now to create a painting almost. I think again it's kind of easier to understand when it's imperfect. When it's too perfect, like a CAD model, it takes all your brain power to try and make sense of it. Whereas if it's kind of wiggly lines, kind of sketchy lines, you kind of see instantly, more easily, what it's actually about. And then you also have watercolour styling now in GIS, so you've probably seen that as well. So this probably doesn't work for every use case, but again, it's interesting to see people trying to replicate hard copy ways of doing maps in an electronic GIS system. So I suppose what's happening here is that you have a new convergence again of tools like high-tech stuff, but also more the arty stuff is coming back together again, which is the first time since the Renaissance, really, because over the last 200 years in our society, we have become more and more specialized. So you had to make a choice. You either had to be an engineer or a scientist or an artist, but you couldn't be all of those things. Whereas now, again, it feels like you can actually be a geospatial scientist and an artist at the same time, which is quite exciting, I think so anyway. Enabling you to bring the two together, really, and experiment. And it's a real craft creating really good maps. It's a really professional craft. This is a nice example, again, made around on Twitter a few weeks ago, which I really liked. A Swiss map showing two variables. It's inequality and income, I think, in Switzerland. And it's done a really good job of showing that data, two variables together on one map. And it's made a really good job of showing where the data is actually applicable, so not in the mountains where nobody lives. It's not like with those election maps where huge empty spaces where nobody lives are still coloured red or blue and are completely misleading. So here you actually get the true picture. That's really well done. You also see 3D models, actually, like I said earlier. It's actually very enjoyable working with 3D models in real life, using your hands to make models. I've also run workshops for more kind of innovation type workshops. And like with Lego, it's amazing how everybody responds to Lego, even adults, maybe especially adults, because we crave it probably more than children, who are allowed to play when they're still young, whereas we are not allowed to play anymore from a certain age. But I've run workshops where it was about either idea generating or problem framing or stuff like that, and using Lego, using your hands to build models which metaphorically show what the problem is or what the solution might be, worked incredibly well. I was so inspired by that, I decided to write a blog post about it. And you have things like AR sandboxes, I don't know if you've seen those before, yeah, so that's great. I didn't actually realize that was a gift. And there's a lot of fun. Also, air traffic controllers, I was intrigued to hear that they're still using paper strips because it's easier to organize in their minds, where the planes are, using like these physical artifacts in front of them, rather than just relying on purely digital screens. They have those as well, of course, but they use both. It's again easier to process that information when you have artifacts. Also, architects, yes, they use 3D CAD models, but they also still make 3D models by hand with cardboard or whatever to explore design models or to show the end design. Because again, especially while you're still in an exploratory phase, as you're building the model, you actually start to see other solutions or problems that arise with that model. So that's why architects to this day, they still use their hands as well as doing stuff on digital screens. So it seems to be like also for us in a geospatial world, I mean, we spent the last 20 years going all out, doing everything on screens, on digital screens, with GIS, and I think maybe we've slightly neglected the analog side of things, and maybe we should slightly pull back on that and bring the two together again. Equally going out in the field, that's probably one of my main regrets. I mean, I've had a great career so far. I've had, travel all around the world, and that's been great, but it was mostly office-based stuff I did, and one or two occasions where I did go out in the field in the Sahara Desert, so it just blew my mind. I was thinking, damn, I should have done this more often, and sooner maybe. So if you're able to go out in the field, please do, because it's just, you get a totally different understanding of it. So, I just want to end this this part of the talk by this quote from Winston Churchill. So, we said that we shape our buildings and then they shape us, and I think the same is true of our workflows. So, we shape our workflows and they shape us. I don't know if you've seen this book, it's quite good actually. But, yeah, because I thought the other day actually, if we had to reinvent our technology from scratch, for example, let's say you want to do some Earth observation, but we didn't have any technology to do it, so you'd have to, if you were in a kind of reality TV show like The Apprentice and you had a week to do it, so how would you go about taking a picture from high up? So you'd either have to invent a hot air balloon or you'd have to invent a rocket or something. But at what point would you invent a room full of computers that people stare at all day long? You probably wouldn't, would you? So it's really something that's crept up on us slowly and slowly, and we haven't even noticed it until all of us spend all our time in offices staring at screens. So that's, it's really this where I think where we need to pull back and actually go back, maybe spend more time out in the field or spend more time exploring stuff with our hands again and working together in an analog way as well. So anyway, that's enough of that. So I'm grateful that you humoured me for this part. So I just want to wrap up with a few thoughts on just what is this geospatial professional and where we're headed with that. So the stuff we do, we do have skills. It is a craft to create good geospatial outputs. I just love this map here. It's a projection that combines all the oceans of the world into one continuous water body. I didn't even know you could do that, but apparently you can. So it takes real craft and ingenuity to do that kind of stuff. So on the other hand, geospatial data representations, aren't maybe that special. There's also loads of other ways you can work with data. Also on Twitter, you always see these debates flaring up, is spatial special or not? I don't know. It maybe is and it isn't. It's a bit like Schrodinger's cat. It is and isn't alive at the same time. So I think it's the same with geospatial. There's certainly a lot more people who are using geospatial without being experts, and that's great. This was an interview with the CEO of Geocarta, who said that the future main users of GIS will not be specialized people. That's probably true, but you will also still need geospatial skills or professional skills that underpins that whole framework, that whole geospatial ecosystem. So it's really both. I suppose we live in a world where everything has to become an ideology. You either open source or you're proprietary. Either GIS is gone mainstream, all our jobs will go, or the robots are coming, or we're all going to die. But it's probably all going to be the both. It's going to be the answers usually in the middle somewhere. And we're always going to need geospatial skills, really, as well, professional skills. Having said that, I don't really understand that this is a piece written by somebody who did a bit of research into earnings of GIS people versus IT people. And of course we have a lot of overlap with IT in what we do. And this guy looked up, this is in America, and he found that people with the same skill sets earn less or more depending on whether their labels are sold as GIS people or IT people. So as IT people you earn about 15% more. I don't understand exactly why that is, but that's maybe something to keep in mind to rebrand yourselves. I wrote a blog post about careers a few years ago, and that was probably my own claim to fame. It went viral on LinkedIn, and you can go look it up. And it's mostly standard stuff and the common sense stuff. But what I've noticed with us geospatial people in communities, we tend to undersell ourselves a bit. So, and perhaps that explains the difference with IT people, I don't know. But we don't seem to think of ourselves as being creative, whereas maybe we misunderstand what creativity actually is, because creativity is really just, it's not starting with a blank sheet and doing something really amazing from scratch. Creativity is really remixing things and taking things that are already there and improving on them, or taking two unrelated ideas and sticking them together, stuff like that. And that's actually the stuff that we do with geospatial. We take maps from here, from there, we combine layers, we create new insights from them. So maybe we need to be a bit more aggressive in how we present ourselves and our skill sets. This is from a talk I gave earlier this year on Earth observation professionals wanting to know a bit more about how to generate more opportunities for themselves commercially. And there's a lot of ways that you can generate income from geospatial data, for example. There's just a few revenue models listed there from that presentation. But the key is, you know, do not undersell yourself. I often see people, you know, charging just $1 for the use of the hammer, and, you know, not realizing that knowing where to tap, you know, has cost you a lot of money and time to know that. It's cost you a lot of education, a lot of experience in your job. So if you work for 10 years or whatever, that is worth something. It's worth a lot more than $1. So you really, you know, need to remember to ask what you're worth out there in the wider world, really, all of us. Yeah. Really, because the maps are weapons, geospatial data is very, very useful. And when you look at the challenges we're facing at the moment, you know, 21st century challenges, I personally have been looking into energy transition over the last year or two, and I've listed there all the climate solutions that already exist and that you find repeated in most places, you know, that talk about these things, and they have geospatial written all over them, really. So, so just to wrap up, really, is the world needs you, needs us, the geospatial community, to do great things with geospatial data and tools and human ingenuity. So, it's Friday, 5:30, and you're all itching for another beer. So, that's all I want to say for today. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. A busy weekend, motivated. Questions? Squeeze in a few questions and then we can maybe grab a beer or juice.
I really liked the, especially the little bit of the idea. I'm more from OpenStreetMap, and there was a little thing that came up recently where we were trying to figure out how we could use OpenStreetMap data to encourage the United Nations sustainability goals. Similar to you said that you're doing work with energy.
I've been looking into the energy transition as a whole thing, because ExpertHub, we work mostly in the energy industry, so we work for oil, gas and renewables companies primarily, also in other sectors. But and you see now quite a lot of oil companies, they are investing in renewables as well, for example, as a transition. And I think they actually, as commercial entities, they're quite concerned that they will be left behind. So they actually, a few of them are investing quite aggressively. But there's a lot more to, for example, climate change solutions than just moving to renewable energy. There's transport issues and other issues. I've been looking at that more generally also for us at ExpertHub and GTEC to see where else are there commercial opportunities. And as I did that, I found that all these areas require geospatial solutions. And in fact, in a lot of these areas, there are already geospatial players actively providing solutions, which is good to see. Fortunately, not for us, for ExpertHub, because it means we then have to compete with an incumbent already there. But no, so, it actually gives me a lot of hope for geospatial, but also for the world at large, that, you know, there are a lot of solutions out there. To implement them is more a political issue than any other issue. And we can certainly help with implementation.
To it yet, because obviously we can't make 3D bronze models of everything we do, because it would take far too long. So maybe it's also the way we work generally, whether as geospatial professionals or otherwise, that we find ways of working that we're not enslaved in front of a screen. For example, with the new technologies, you can take your GIS out into the field on your mobile phone or And if you can do that to solve a problem, maybe that's a better way of doing it than doing it from behind the screen. I mean, there's always opportunities where you can introduce excuses to either draw by hand or do something by hand. When I'm in a meeting, I always scribble by hand, I doodle by hand, I draw pictures by hand, just because it amuses me, but it also keeps me alert, and I just use strategies like that to make my everyday more handy. But yeah, I haven't got an overall solution. I'm still working on that, so if you have any ideas, let me know. Maybe like with things like holographic technologies and where you can actually swipe things in 3D space like that. Maybe that kind of thing. But I'm constantly looking for excuses to use my hands more than I would otherwise do.
I think it should be reintroduced drawing. I've just been perfecting my Photoshop skills after 20 years. But yes, drawing skills revision is maybe one question.
I have questions along a similar
line.
Are you optimistic that employers accept that they'll have a happier, productive, more productive workforce if they move away from the model you mentioned of sitting behind a desk?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually looked at, I am actually interested in the general issue of productivity in the workplace, which goes beyond geospatial. And I do see a trend with some of the more enlightened companies. They're beginning to re-architect their offices. They're enlisting interior architects and actually not just architects, they're enlisting psychologists and other kind of people. Where they rearrange office spaces in a way where there's not just rows of computers, but you have spaces to work. If you really need to work on something without distraction, you have spaces for that. You have spaces for interaction. You have spaces for moving about a bit. You have spaces with natural light, which is more like a general well-being thing. And you can see that slowly coming. Obviously, it's more expensive to do that. It actually takes more floor space as well. I mean, open plan was introduced for collaboration, which was a load of baloney, really. It was introduced because it's cheaper. It's a cheaper use of floor space, which then means that, yeah, it might be great for collaboration, for talking to people, but it disturbs those people who need to work without distraction. And as a result, they did a lot of studies on that, and they've actually found that a decreased collaboration over plan offices, because people, rather than talking to each other, they email or IM each other, because they don't want to speak because it disturbs people. But I think there's a general societal trend in the workplace happening, and starting with the more enlightened employers who are remodeling their offices accordingly. That they're more pleasant workspaces. Perhaps once we've got those, maybe we can have an AR sandbox in there, or we can have some play tables with Lego, or for easy 3D model building, or for drawing. I don't know.
There was a fad for big open circulation spaces, but not very practical. You build a building, don't put a computer lab in it. We still need that.
That's the key. You still need all of those things, but I think they need to be arranged differently.
That's good. I know we both have chatted about spare rooms. What do we put in the spare room once we've got rid of the current stuff? But actually, maybe you have better, more articulate thoughts on that than I do. Was there a question, actually, before I ramble on? Abby?
Yeah, Terry, thank you for your presentation. I was thinking of the point you were saying about the democratization of geospatial technology and software, that actually a lot of people think they can do things now themselves, and then why do they need a professional? But then at the end, you're selling, actually we need to upsell our skills in terms of making the case that it isn't just about the tool, it's about all your training and learning. Are those kind of two things that are quite difficult, that people are thinking more they can do things themselves, but actually we're also trying to upskill ourselves, upsell ourselves mistake that's actually not going to need photographers anymore because everyone can do it themselves on their phone. But then with the rise of things like Instagram, actually the value of high quality photography has almost risen. So it's like all the kind of shifts have kind of risen on the tide. Do you see that happening with geospatial in your work? Do you see actually because things are more accessible now, people are asking for higher quality and it's putting us into a better position? Or will our skills just kind of dissipate?
Yeah, that's a good point. I suppose everybody can do things themselves like with drones and create your own 3D models or whatever, create your own maps. What I see as a consultant working mostly with energy companies, they ask us to come in, even though they can do things themselves, they ask us to come in to kind of clean up and tidy up and restructure and optimize their workflows. Because yes, you can do things yourselves, but if you have a team of 20 people and everybody works differently, it ends up with complete chaos. So you need to have some kind of standardized, optimal way of working where you can just do like the tedious bits really quickly. Either we automate them, automate their update routines or whatever, so that they're more free to do their creative stuff. Like with geologists, you know, they love thinking in 3D and 4D and thinking of new models. That's a good question about whether you know, they realize the value. I mean, we constantly have to explain that what the value is of us coming in. It's a constant struggle. But invariably, when we do go in somewhere, we enjoy doing what we do, and the client always enjoys the result, and they're really pleased that they called us in. So it's just that it took them that initial hurdle to call us, really. So, and I guess maybe we aren't doing enough to explain the value of our services either, I don't know. But it's a good question. This is kind of a contradiction, and I don't have the complete answer to that either. That's, I guess, why I put it in there. We need to collectively, you've done a lot of work at the AGI to explain the proposition to the wider public, really.
Is the hurdle kind of changing? Actually, people understand the value of geospatial models. It's less about selling the value of geospatial, and over time, do people then.
Yeah, it just reminds me actually, when I gave a talk quite similar to this at the BCS a couple of months ago, I got a question at the end from a lady from the Geospatial Commission, and she asked me if I were to invest in geospatial skills, in which skills would I be investing as a society? And I said, well, actually, I hadn't thought of that question before, so I was kind of thinking out loud, and I ended up saying that, well, actually, we probably don't need geospatial experts to be even more specialized than they already are, so we don't need to upskill ourselves that much. It's more about upskilling general public in their spatial literacy. As a society, we would probably achieve a lot more change by having everybody in the population more spatially literate than having a few more experts who are super experts at what they do. Again, I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's what I came up with at the time. So, it's tricky. Right.
Sounding good. Proper photography and upskilling of GIS for the general public. Lots of employment opportunities, regardless of whatever future. I think it could be near beer o'clock. It's all very interesting. The health benefits of getting out of the office, I'm all for that. Talking of which, it's a short stroll over to the TV and Library Bar. Do come and join us for that. But basically, thank you all very much for coming. There is a talk, 24th of January. There may be a sort of vaguely sort of GIS-y talk before that, actually. But our first one is the 24th of January. Look out for that. More on the GI and space and satellites and things. The Scottish Government angle. So look out for that in due course. But have a good festive break. Thank you all for coming, and therefore it just remains to say thank you very much indeed to Thierry for a very interesting, thought-provoking talk.